And welcome back. Another weekend has come and gone. Starting off a new week. We're in the middle of March already. Amazing. I think spring is... Where is spring? Spring. Somewhere in this month is spring. My calendar... St. Patrick's Day. That's Wednesday. We'll figure it out. Back with us tonight are three remarkable gentlemen. One perhaps a little more remarkable than the other two in terms of his longevity and some of the things he has directly participated in. But first up, let's welcome back Ruben Uriarte, the Northern California Director of the Mutual UFO Network. Ruben, are you there?
I'm right here, Jeff. Thanks again for having us on your show.
Well, my pleasure.
We know there's a lot more to the story, and the Colonel has, like you said, he's a remarkable man.
Indeed. And our other esteemed colleague, Noe Torres, is standing by, I hope. Are you there, Noe?
Yes, Jeff. I'm right here. I've enjoyed corresponding with you this past week by email as we were getting everything set for tonight and also talking to the Colonel. So I'm really looking forward to tonight's show.
Well, thank you. So am I. All right, the man of the hour, or 2 hours, as it is scheduled to be, Colonel Robert Willingham, U.S. Air Force, retired. Colonel, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Welcome back, my friend. Glad to hear your voice.
Thank you very much.
How have you been?
I've been looking forward to tonight anyway.
Good. It's... Yes, listen to that laugh. I know we're in for it now, folks. Daylight savings time started. Now, when you were a boy, did they have daylight savings time back then? Did we mess with the clocks?
Not till World War II started.
I see. I figured it wasn't. And do you think we could get along without daylight savings time?
I could. Wouldn't bother me a bit.
All right.
I don't wear a watch anymore anyway since I retired.
I'm with you, Colonel, and I don't wear a watch either. I don't. I just look at the sun and I go by that pretty much. All right, my friend. I want to go back, if you would, and I'm interested to find out what your childhood was like. That's always our young people now, as you well know, don't even speak our language. They don't understand our values, our morals. They don't understand what we went through. What you went through is far more than I have, but the gap is extraordinarily large. And when one looks at the so-called entertainment our young people cover themselves in, it's kind of frustrating. But where did you grow up, and what kind of a childhood did you have?
Well, I was born over in Holladay, Texas.
Holladay.
Yeah, and I was 3 years old. My daddy took an Indian agent job in New Mexico.
I see.
And we had a little property out there, about 1,280 acres, and we raised stock and stuff for food for the Indians, the Mascalera Apache. And I went started to school with them when I was 6 years old.
Really? At an Indian school?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
At Lucy.
Right.
A little town called Lucy, New Mexico.
Well,
not there anymore.
Oh, it's gone. Wow.
Yeah, I was out there about 6-7 years ago, and everything around there was gone.
Wow.
We had a filling station, a post office, and a couple of big houses, and the school was there.
It's all gone?
It was all gone.
What about Holladay? Is Holladay still there?
Oh, yeah. In fact, it's grown about 2,000.
All right. Well, that's some good news. I just found out on my calendar... It does include spring this year, and spring starts this next Saturday.
Right. All right.
Now,
they haven't messed it up yet.
You're right about that. Give them a little more time. They'll commercialize the heck out of it. So you went to school with the Indian kids, and for how long?
I only got to stay at first year. My daddy got transferred back to Texas. So we moved to Texas, and I started the school over at Holiday, where I was born.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went a year, 2 years over there, and then we moved again, and I started at another school.
Well, all right. So brothers and sisters, solid family and all that?
What's that?
You had brothers and sisters?
No. I was the only one.
So you had mom and dad and young Bobby?
It's me, yeah.
Okay. All right. All right. So for those of you who don't know, the colonel went on to serve with distinction in World War II. And after that, the Korean War. And after that, was in the U.S. Air Force Reserves. And the story is up there at sightings.com in detail. You can hear the entire interview we did last Monday. Now, what I'd like to do, with your permission, sir, if we can, is go back and I don't really worry about exact dates. I can't remember what I did last week. So I'm not going to expect you to remember what happened half a century ago. But if you can, you mentioned on the program last time that you've been to a number of UFO crash sites. And
right.
I think you said the first one was around 1940. Have you reflected on that first one anymore, and can you nail that down for us a little bit and tell us what you remember about it?
Yes. We went there, and I was pretty young then, and we looked around quite a bit. Didn't find anything. They had already picked everything up from it.
When you say, Colonel, you were pretty young, approximately how old were you?
Oh, I say
1940.
1940?
That's, yeah. That's just when the war started, 1941.
I'd say I was about 17.
Okay.
18.
And how did you find out about this UFO or unidentified object crashing back then? Was it in the newspapers?
Yes, it was in the newspapers, and I was staying with some friends at his daddy kept up with all that stuff. Hmm. And we just went out there and looked around, me and a couple of his boys, and we couldn't find a thing.
Where was this, Colonel? Where was this, Colonel?
This was out in West Texas.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it was not I had suggested it might be in Missouri, but you're remembering it was in West Texas.
Yeah, it was out close to La Mesa.
Okay. Were there any marks on the ground? Were there been vehicles and trucks or anything at all?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And that's what kind of aggravated me a little bit. The government, a little later on, we'll say up in the 50s or, you know,
mm-hmm.
or maybe back in 48, 49 or somewhere along there, they'd say there's a crash. And I was in within 3 miles of one up here by Pittsburgh. Is northeast of Pittsburgh, about 20 miles. And the Air Force come in and picked it all up. You'd think they vacuum cleaned it.
Well, from what we know about Roswell, they had, I don't know, several hundred people or a couple hundred anyway, literally on the ground on their hands and knees, crawling forward inch by inch, looking for every tiny piece of wreckage. So they did basically vacuum up all the evidence. Okay,
right.
Hold on, Colonel. We have to pause for just a couple minutes. We'll come right back. So this was
a lot of money while you're there.
Well, just enough to keep going. It's good enough for me. All right, that was in Pittsburgh. That's Texas, I assume.
That was one of them, yeah.
All right. Very good. Stand by. We're talking with Colonel Robert Willingham, U.S. Air Force Reserve, retired. We'll continue our conversation in just a couple. And welcome back. Talking with Colonel Robert Willingham, a U.S. Air Force Reserve colonel who served in World War II and it seemed like a World War to those who were there, the Korean War, and then was involved in all kinds of things after that and before as well. Now, you talked about the Pittsburgh crash site, Colonel. How did you find out about that one? And it was, you say, only several miles from your home at the time. That's pretty interesting. And how did you know the Air Force was the one there to pick everything up? Was it just the general military, or did you have word that the Air Force was there?
Well, at that time, I was working for an oil company, and I maintained the pipeline that went through there.
Oh.
And okay. I was downtown eating dinner, and they were talking about I had a crash up there about 10 minutes ago. I said, yeah, whereabouts? And they told me. So I said, well, thank you very much. And we got in my vehicle, and we took off out there, me and my buddy. And we got out there, and they was Air Force people that were, as you say, down on their knees picking everything up. And I did walk over to the truck at a big piece he had picked up and looking it over. And one of them walked up there and told me, no, you can't look at that. Said, that's all belongs to the Air Force now. I said, I just reached in my pocket and pulled out my ID card. And I said, I belong to the Air Force too. And he said, oh, well, go ahead and look if you want to.
Really?
But don't say nothing about it.
Interesting. What year would that have been, Colonel?
That was about 60, I believe.
Okay. So that's interesting because it happened after your F-86 chase and observation and what we talked about last week. So
yeah,
these unusual events continued to cross your life's path years later. That's most unusual.
Yeah.
Pittsburgh, Texas, 1960 or thereabouts. Well, by then they were very good at cleaning up crash sites. If something had crashed and they were on it within about 10 or 15 minutes, that's a darned fast response time, and I'm wondering how they did it. Was there an Air Force base nearby, and maybe they tracked this thing down?
Oh, there's a big Air Force base at Pittsburgh.
Oh, I see.
I mean, yeah, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Oh, this is in Pennsylvania.
Texas.
Very good. Okay, so you're in PA working for an oil company in 1960, is after
yeah.
You got out of the service. Was the piece of wreckage on a flatbed truck, in a pickup truck, in a covered deuce and a half? What was it in?
Yeah, it was on a flatbed truck or trailer, semi-trailer.
Mm-hmm.
And then he had a couple of bobtail trucks that they had loaded stuff on.
What'd this piece look like?
It just looked like a piece of thin aluminum that somebody had throwed off my truck or something and run over it a couple of times, and that's about all there was to it.
Pretty messed up.
I couldn't find nothing pertaining to the power system to it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I've been looking for, is what makes them go.
Now, was this, Colonel, still a time, or was it before the time you began working with your friend who has passed on now about 10 years, who was attached to the Pentagon? Was that before those days?
That was before him, yeah. He wasn't on that one, but I can't remember for sure if it was before he passed away or he couldn't get there to help or what it was.
Well, now, this is 1960 approximately, and if your friend passed away about 10 years ago, that would have put it well back there, and he should have been. I'm just curious as to when you met him and how you met him. About what year was that? Would it have been after the Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania event? It must have been.
Yes, it was. quite a few years after that, seemed to me like. I met Zekel at...
You met who, sir?
Zekel.
What's
that was his name.
What is his name, please?
Z-E-C-K-E-L.
Zekel. All right. Is that a first name or a last name?
No, I think that was his last name.
All right.
I called him Zekel all the time. But
all right.
You know us Texans.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I do. All right. Now, where did you meet Zekel? Under what circumstance, to the best of your ability to recall it?
I believe that I was at a, what they called a unidentified flying object reunion that they were having in Ohio. And he was seated at our table for chow that day. And I got acquainted with him and everything, and he was asked me, was I chasing unidentified flying objects? And I said, well, I have been a little bit. And he said, where at? And I said, well, everywhere I'm at. I do a lot of traveling. And I'm in Texas 1 month and maybe in Pennsylvania the next month and New York the next one, but... I said, we get around a little bit.
And you always watch the newspapers. And back in the 50s and 60s, they used to report these things, so...
Yeah, but they don't do it anymore.
No, sir, they sure don't. Not since around the 70s, early 70s. The lid came down on it. All right, if you would stand by, we'll have a long segment just in a couple of minutes as we continue. I'm very interested in that dinner you went to, so I'll ask you a question or two about that one. When we continue, about that unidentified flying object reunion dinner, I'm curious about that.
Okay.
Well, just a little bit. We'll do more, and glad you're along tonight, ladies and gentlemen. Ruben Uriarte, Noe Torres are here, I'm here, and so is the Colonel, and we'll be right back. Okay, and we're back talking with Colonel Willingham. All right, so we're talking about Mr. Zekel and the dinner. The dinner was held where, Colonel, and what organization put the dinner on?
It was held at Carlisle, Pennsylvania.
The home of Jim Thorpe.
Yep, sure is. Was in my back door.
All right. So who held the dinner?
There was a private organization that worked with the Storm Watch.
Okay.
They had two-way radios, and they tracked storms and things like that, and had different radar systems that they used, and first one thing another. So they was a good outfit to watch for flying objects, you know. And so they throwed a big dinner down there one night, and Zekel was there.
Okay.
And I don't know, that was seemed to me like was about maybe 58, 59, somewhere around there.
Okay.
Or it might have.
Well, you got the crash in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, around 1960, to the best of your recollection. And the dinner was before that or after that? Can you track that?
The one where were we at? Pittsburgh.
Yeah, I'm thinking if the dinner was after that Pittsburgh crash when you went out there, it was on your pipeline property, would that dinner would have been after that?
I believe it was pretty close to the same time, somewhere around there, you know, a week or two apart, maybe.
Very good. All right, so you and Zekel hit it off, and so how did that begin your association? What did he say to you? Hey, let's get together and work on these things? And
Well, we had one down here in this area, and he called me about it. I gave him one of my cards where he could call me if he ever wanted to.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's just, we're back in Texas now, right?
Yeah.
All right.
And we met up at Wichita Falls and discussed things, and I had different airplanes set up through Civil Air Patrol and personal aircraft and stuff to go look for people that's lost and airplanes that are down and stuff like that.
Sure.
So I just organized them together. That way we have communications, aircraft to look to see what they see on the ground and all that kind of stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I was pretty well set up for by 1970, pretty good.
So you were using the Civil Air Patrol to do two things, to look for stranded aviators and downed aircraft, and to look into crashed UFO reports.
Well, we wouldn't exactly call them. We just call them bogies.
Okay, but I get the picture.
Because we don't talk about that over the two-way radios too much.
I understand.
And besides that, we were using Air Force and private aircraft and stuff. You don't want to be talking about that over their radios.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Back to the Pittsburgh crash around 1960. You were at the scene. They already had everything picked up off the ground, basically, and were looking for the small, tiny pieces. And you were able to look at this thing on the truck. Was this daylight or nighttime, Colonel? You remember?
Well, it was beginning to get a little dark. It wasn't exactly dark yet, but the sun was going down.
Was this a disc-like craft, or was it shaped differently?
No, it was a round one, like they draw them all the time. I've seen three or four that was oblong, like cigar type. But I never could get close enough to really see anything that's going on with them. I hadn't seen one of the crashes of that except back in the 50s. It was one. And they claimed it was an unidentified flying object.
Right.
Well, looked to me like somebody had made something, you know.
Well, that's what happened in the, like we talked about earlier, those reports just dried up about in the 70s, early 70s, when the door shut on everything. The military decided that the people didn't have the right to know that these things were either being shot down or otherwise crashing. And these were fairly common events, apparently. We have officially close to 100 crash sites now identified by one organization that's looking into this kind of thing now. So let me go back to you and Mr. Zeckel. How many events did you two go together on? Take a guess. How many different crash sites over the years? You got along real well with him, obviously.
I'd say about 8 of them.
And sometimes would he call you and say, hey, let's get together and get on over here or over there, and you jump in a plane and fly to meet him? How did it work?
Well, that's the way we do it. If it was close to somewhere, you know, an airport and stuff like that, he'd rent a car and meet me there.
Mm-hmm.
So or sometimes he'd come to another big airport where we was going to meet at. Mm-hmm. There were plenty of cars to rent there.
I see. Did you ever have the feeling that he might be working in some capacity for some agency in the government?
Well, yes, I knew he worked for a little bit for the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see, what was the other outfit? He was also, he taught at a university somewhere up there around, I don't know, it seemed to me like it was up about a little above Chicago or somewhere around through there.
So he didn't hide the fact from you that he was attached to the CIA or the NSA or some other government agency.
Well, I just happened to be at the Pentagon one time, the same time he was. He come walking down the hall, and he said that was his office down there on the other end.
Oh, well, hold on now, Colonel. We'll take a break, a quick break, and come back, and I'm curious to find out what you just happened to be at the Pentagon doing, too. This is what a life you've had. Amazing. All right. Be right back with Colonel Willingham as we continue in just a couple of minutes. Okay, and we're back talking with Colonel Robert Willingham, U.S. Air Force Reserve, retired. All right, Colonel, what were you doing in the Pentagon?
Oh, I was up there talking to the president.
The president of what?
Of the United States.
That's what I figured. And I'm not even from Texas. Now, what were you doing?
His name was Johnson.
All right. Did you know Lyndon Johnson from Texas?
Very muchly so. When he ran for office, I sold his newspapers for him.
Oh. As in newspaper businesses. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
A little magazine type newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
And the people went for it gung-ho.
So you maintained your friendship with Lyndon Johnson, and you were up in D.C., and you went over, and he was at the Pentagon. What did he say? Bob, come on over here. Let's get together for lunch, or what was the meeting about?
At what it was, to eat dinner.
Very good. So you're walking down the hall by yourself, and you happen to see, or were you weren't walking with the president at the time, were you?
Nope.
Okay, you're walking down the
hall. That was a different time altogether.
Yeah, you've been around, my friend. Just imagine, folks, if you just tuned in and joined us, Colonel Willingham, 87, has been through 5 strokes, 2 wars, had terrible physical injuries, which he's dealt with all his life, and was a very close friend of Lyndon Johnson's. All right, so you saw Zekel, you just happened to run into him, or it seemed that way, in the Pentagon,
yeah.
And he said, my office is just down the way here.
That's what he said.
Did you go down to his office?
No, I didn't. I was in a hurry. I was on another job.
Okay. I understand. Zekel, obviously in military intelligence or CIA or NSA, somewhere along the line there, and
yeah.
You went to, you say, around 8 maybe? 7 or 8 or 9 different crashes. And,
right. Yeah.
All right. And that would have been in the 60s and 70s, pretty much?
Yeah, there were a few in the late part of 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Over. In fact, that one above Pittsburgh up there, I believe it was about 60.
Okay. Now, Johnson became... Johnson became president, of course, in 1963.
Right.
You met Zekel at that meeting before or after, had to have been before Johnson became president, right?
Yes, I believe you're right there. I hadn't thought much about it, but I believe you're right.
Okay. All right. So let's go through and pick up on some of these UFO crash sites that Zekel would call you. I should maybe be calling him Mr. Zekel, but this is Texas talk, right?
Right.
So Zekel would call you and he'd say, hey, we got something cooking over near you or over near me. And you'd jump on a plane, be it CAP or commercial, and you'd meet him somewhere. Tell us about one or two of these things that stand out in your mind most. Let's just say you flew somewhere and he picked you up in a rental car and you went to the location. Did you get to any of those locations when the debris from the crashed object was still on the ground?
Very little, because it was always about 5 to 6 hours later when we got there.
Understand.
And most of it was pretty well picked up. But sometimes I'd get the one before they did. And that's the one I liked.
I bet.
That way I could see what the whole thing looked like.
Would that have been... Go ahead. Go ahead, Colonel, please.
I'd get there where I could see what the whole thing looked like, get some idea of the shape and everything. I've been looking all the time to find out what makes them fly. They're nothing like, you know, our airplanes or anything like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to know why it flew. And I never did find no power system in there to make it fly. So I just come up with some ideas of my own, and I went to working on them. And Zekel thought that was a good idea, and I did too, and he worked on it a little bit.
Really? Mm-hmm.
You know, and try to get something going.
Now,
I really wanted to get in there and take a ride with one of them, you know, and get acquainted with them, but they didn't let me do that.
From our visit last week, you've seen inside a crashed craft, you've seen dead occupants, pilots, whatever they are, you've seen a lot of things. The times you've been able to beat the military to a crash site, was Zekel with you on any of those occasions, or was that just Colonel Willingham acting on his own and hearing about something and getting there very quickly?
Well, yes, he joined me on one. I believe that was in Ohio, but I can't think of the name of the town right now that it was, but it was one... trying to think if I could pinpoint the date on it, but I don't believe I can.
Okay, well,
but
you
anyway,
two, you both got there.
Well, yeah, it was off out in somewhere in the country, awful tall trees, tall pines, and things, and I got there and I got a good look and took some pretty good pictures of it. And he got there about 3 hours later. But there was still some of it there. And the Air Force finally got there and started picking it up. But Jekyll got there before it was all picked up.
How did you first hear about that particular crash, Colonel? Do you remember?
Yeah, an old farmer out there, and he was waving at me, and I pulled in there because I looked after them pipelines in that area.
So that's why you traveled so much, I see. You were always checking on pipelines, moving around.
Yeah, I sure did. There's one thing Mr. Johnson, or President Johnson, always said. You keep taking care of them pipelines because we don't want nothing burning up.
That's good. I like that. Very good. All right. So somebody pulled you over or flagged you down, you're driving, and said what?
He said, hey, I said, did you see that thing come flying in here? And I said, no, I didn't see it. He said, well, it hit right up there on the side of that hill. I said, he did. And he said, yeah. So I told my guy at the office, I called him on the company phone, told him to call Zekel and tell him he's one of our targets that went down, and gave him a closest little town here.
Mm-hmm.
And he got there in about 3 hours.
That's pretty fast.
It sure was. It come right on down.
Well, you go up there then, you're the first person on the site, Colonel?
No, there was four or five of the citizens that lived around that place.
Uh-huh.
And they was out there looking around too, you know.
What was it? What did you see? What did it look like? Tall trees. Okay.
Yeah. And it was a circular type one. Round circle on the bottom, and then the top stood up a little bit, like where you could probably look out the windows if there were somebody in there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And but it had tore some of the, I guess it hit one of them trees or something. It took a big chunk right out of the side of it.
About how big was it, Colonel? A diameter?
I'd say it was about 25 feet across.
Mm-hmm. And how thick?
Oh, I'd say it was about 6 foot.
Okay. And what were there any markings on the outer skin of this craft? And I assume this was still daylight.
Yeah, it was daylight then. No, there wasn't no markings on it. I walked around it pretty good to see if it did.
Mm-hmm.
Because I always like to get them markings and take pictures of them.
Right. Could you see inside the craft at the time?
No, I guess when it hit them big trees and stuff, it fractured the celluloid or what they had on there, or glass or what it was,
mm-hmm.
and you couldn't see very good through it. So I didn't see no people in there.
Could you see any lights on inside at all?
No, not after he hit, no.
Hmm. So you took some pictures. Did you happen to give those pictures to Zeckel by any chance?
Yes, I did. Sure
how did. How did I know that?
Yeah, how did you know that? In fact, they hadn't even developed, and I just gave him the whole camera. And he took it, and he sent me the prettiest Leica C3 you ever seen to take pictures with.
Very nice. So you got a camera back, but you didn't get your pictures back, did you?
Oh, he mailed me a copy of them, and...
He did.
Who'd I give them to? I gave them to a guy who was writing a book.
Very interesting. All right. Hold on a sec. We got to do another little break here. We'll come back. Go get yourself a glass of water. Take
yes,
care of business.
Yes, I got me a glass of water right last one.
Very good. All right. Hang on, Colonel.
I'll smoke a cigarette this round.
Uh-oh. You're tougher than I thought. Wow. All right. Hang on. We'll be back, gang, with Colonel Robert Willingham and more in just a few minutes. And welcome back, Jeff Rentz and Ruben Uriarte and Noe Torres. The special guest again tonight, as he was a week ago, is Colonel Robert Willingham, U.S. Air Force Reserve retired, veteran of World War II and the Korean War, and all kinds of fascinating things on top of that. Back to that crash we were talking about a few minutes ago, Colonel, the one you got there, just you and four or five other locals before the military did, and then Zeckel got there. What did Zeckel say when he got up to the site? You remember? What kind of remarks did he make?
He said, "Boy, you found a good one this time, didn't you?"
That's
I
funny.
Told him, "Yeah, I got here before they tore everything up."
What did he say?
He said, "Well, I'm sure glad." And I said, "Yeah, you if you'd have been an hour later, you wouldn't even got to see that, because they already had it loaded on a flatbed."
Wow. When they picked the thing up, they had a crane, obviously, of some kind, to lift it up, put it on the flatbed.
They had a side boom.
Okay. The craft itself at 25 feet wide, unless it was pretty well dented in, would have been pretty wide on that truck. And I'm wondering how they got it out of there, or was the thing collapsed in so much that it wouldn't have stuck out all that far? Or did they put it up on end?
Well, no, they laid it down, but it was part of it missing.
Mm-hmm.
And they covered it with a tarp.
Yeah.
As much as they could. And put side wings on it to where the people would be sure they see it, wouldn't mm-hmm. run into it.
Okay.
And then they had cops all over that place, helping get it out of there after he got it on the highway.
Hmm.
And, I don't know where they took it. I didn't even find out. Cause I'd already seen all I wanted to see of it.
When you were at crash sites with Zekel, did the military seem to leave you and him alone?
Yes, they did. After the first encounter we had with them one time, I went and got me a pass that would be all right to go on any of these that I wanted to look at.
Where'd you get the pass from?
That's a personal thing.
All right, sir. No problem at all. Understand. So what you're saying is Lyndon Johnson wrote you a letter and you carried it with you.
I did that too, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Sure did.
All right. Well, I would do the same. All right.
Yeah.
Now, there's a very famous crash in Pennsylvania, and it's commonly called the Kecksburg Crash. 1965.
The Pittsburgh Crash?
Well, Kecksburg.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
All right.
But that's right above Pittsburgh.
Yeah, it's in Pennsylvania, right. A lot of stuff happening in Pennsylvania. So were you at that location in 65 at that Kecksburg crash where that acorn-looking thing came down in that little gully?
I went out and to the place, but they had hauled everything off.
Already
gone. I
got
there too late.
Mm-hmm.
I was over in Germany at that time.
You flew home for the Kecksburg crash?
Well, no, I just came home and
I see.
I was a little late getting there.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like you beat him on that Ohio crash pretty good. So
we done pretty good on that one. And
right.
I'll tell you something else. You probably had seen or read it in the paper or something. They was claiming these unidentified flying objects were landing in water, and they'd go down under the water and stay a while.
They're still doing that today, yeah.
Yeah. I went to the one at, Cleveland, Ohio. They claim they seen one crash into the water and later came out. So I got one of my friends that lived there, and I told him, I said, anytime you see several of them there, would you take some pictures of them or what it may be? And he did. He got one coming out of the water.
Huh. Must have been spectacular. Did he give you a copy of the picture?
Well, he was going to, but I never did. I had a stroke about that time, and I stayed in the hospital pretty good, and then they mm-hmm. took me to Walter Reed and stayed up there a while.
Well,
got out of there. Excuse me.
Yes, you're excused, sir. Don't worry about
Thank
it.
Okay.
Now, back to the camera full of photos that you took and you handed over to Zekel. He sent you copies of those pictures later on, and you gave them to somebody writing a book. That was very nice of you. What happened to the pictures? Did the author give them back to you?
He was going to, but I got lost from him. But he did make a print the book.
Uh-huh.
And I got to see one of the books. Zekel had one of them.
Do you remember the name? Do you remember the name of the book?
I was trying to think what the name was of it. Don't be shocked, it's true, I believe is the name of it was. or something like it.
That's a good title. All right, I'll buy that. Okay,
yeah.
I'd like to hear whatever you'd like to talk about, any of the other events that you and Zekel went on that were of interest, were different, unusual. Sound like they all are in their own right quite unusual, of course, but tell us another story about one.
Well, really, if they have already cleaned up around there, there wasn't too much we could, you know, do about it.
Right.
But just say if one did crash there. But I never even seen where the farmers and things out there would shoot at them, you know. But they never shot one down that I know of.
That brings me to my next question.
Okay.
Why, and we touched upon this a little bit last time, but for our newcomers and to cover this a little more thoroughly, why were so many of these things coming down? What do you think?
Well, I think it was the right weather and temperature and everything for them to travel good. See, they're moving somewhere between, 100,000 miles or something like that, to get in here.
Some of the estimates have tracked them at the space shuttle footage, have tracked some of those craft leaving the Earth's atmosphere at 50 to 100 miles an hour, or 100,000 miles an hour. Yeah.
Yeah. So if the weather and everything's right here, like not too much wind blowing or too wet or ever what it may be, I don't think the water or anything like that bothers it. It just makes it difficult to fly in it, you know, when it's raining and the wind are blowing and what have you.
Uh-huh.
And you got to kind of take care a little bit about that.
So over the years, in all the crash sites you've been to, some with craft, some with debris, some with not much left of anything, when you were able to look inside these objects on a couple of occasions, at least one that we know about, you really didn't see a whole lot of stuff in there. There was not a big engine or propulsion system you could see, no nuclear reactor, nothing like that. It sounds like they're basically kind of empty inside except for the crew and whatever the crew sat in.
Well, yeah, and I'll tell you something else. The crew, I never heard of it more than three in one.
Uh-huh.
Everybody I talked to had looked in it. That had those in there, they only had three crewmen.
Mm-hmm.
That was all. Then they come out and made a movie about one, and they had 12 in it, or maybe 30, I don't know.
Well, that's Hollywood for you. They can do whatever they want.
Oh, yeah.
Did Zekel, who probably had more inside information than you did he ever say anything to you about who they were, where they came from, about what the Pentagon thought?
Not a word.
Okay, he was doing his job then, wasn't he?
Yes, he was.
All right. Stand by if you would, Colonel. We have to take another break, please. We'll come right back with you in just a couple minutes. I'm amazed.
How much longer?
Are you getting tired, sir?
Yes.
All right. How about five more minutes after the break?
Okay.
Very good. Hang on, we'll be right back with you.
All right.
And we'll be right back with you folks as well in just a few. Okay, back with Colonel Robert Willingham. Colonel, we just have about 4 minutes left, so what would you like to mention to our listeners that sticks out in your mind that you think we might really enjoy hearing? I'm going to leave this kind of up to you if there's something you'd like to talk about, just for a couple of minutes here.
Well, you know, we know that at one time we was having sites in several different parts of the United States, reported of different aircraft and stuff that they had that went up the inspector, and they couldn't even stay close to them.
Right.
So later on, down in South America, they had them going on down there, and they were having 14 to 15 of them at a time come down through the edge of the seashore and fly around. And finally, I talked a bunch in, getting their jets out, and let's go down and look and see what's going on down there. And we, one went down, and he seen one of the flying saucers.
This is in South America?
He thought he seen one.
This is in South America?
South America.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And they had all kinds of pictures of them that they had took, the government had.
That been Brazil or Argentina?
Yeah.
Brazil?
No, it was Brazil, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned something about groups of them. Up here, we see maybe, you know, two, three. Down there, they do have larger formations of them. In Mexico,
right.
They've seen a couple of dozen at a time in a loose formation.
Flying in formation.
That's right.
Yeah.
So it's almost...
that's why I wanted to see some of them.
Yeah.
You know.
Of course.
According to the pictures and stuff they showed me of them, though, they were just like them round discs that they had here.
Colonel, do you still... Nah, I can't go there. Did you still have any contact at all with anybody in the government about what you experienced, what you did back then, or is that pretty much now a closed chapter?
Yep, that's a closed chapter.
All right.
They don't want to talk about it.
Why the cover up? Why the secrecy? When we had so many reports and so many newspaper stories in the 50s and 60s, you chased them. Why do you think the cover up is such a big deal to the government? And you don't like the way that they enforce that cover up either. You made that clear last time.
Yes, you're right. I don't approve of it at all. But what happened? They was more of them getting here all the time, and they wanted to keep it a secret. And I said, how can you keep it a secret when if one flew over the top of the Capitol building, 100 feet above it, and they're not going to bother you. They're not going to do nothing to you. I said, why are you so upset about it? Well, it's just not good for the country. I said, well, tell me one thing that really they did that would cause something in this country to be bad. And they said, well, we can't tell you that. And I said, well, you better tell me that or something, because I'm not going anymore.
Good for you. So they suggested to you that there was some kind of negative fallout from the visitors.
Yeah.
All right, but they wouldn't tell you what it was.
They wouldn't tell me what it was or anything. Now, a lot of them crashed on, I'd say most of them crashed on their own. You
really?
Know, something happened to the... mechanically to the flying saucer.
Last question, Colonel. Where do you think, sir, they come from?
Well, there's three places out in the universe that we think they come from.
All right.
And they're finding more out about it right now than they ever have. They had a little part of it on TV the other night showing some of the stuff they found up in the, out in the outer edge of the universe.
Right. There are billions of Earth-size and Earth-like planets just in our galaxy alone. So to say
that's
that we're
right.
the only
yeah.
thing is absurd. Do you believe, sir, that we've had any direct contact at any level with these beings?
I don't think we have, but there's several places up north in the northern part of the universe that they believe they've seen them with that big telescope we got.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going in and out, flying in and out of this place up there.
I see. Well, there's no doubt we're being visited routinely to this very day. It's obvious. Colonel, I thank you very much again for your time. It's been a real pleasure speaking with you, sir. Thank you.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I enjoyed it, and I'm glad to know that somebody is interested in it besides me.
Well, a lot of us out here, sir. And if you come up with anything you'd like to share with our listeners, you just let Reuben or Noe know about it, and we'll have you back on at your convenience.
Well, now I got a whole bunch of 8mm tapes that I'm going to give Reuben
very good.
See if he can find out anything on
there. All right. Thank you, sir. Get some rest. Take care. Okay, we continue, and back with us, Reuben Uriarte and Noe Torres. Gentlemen, what did you think? Reuben, first up.
Jeff, like you were saying, that in talking with the colonel, and you know, he's been through a lot, you know, with his health, going through several strokes, and yet, remarkably, he still has been very, very sharp on a number of things. And I think one of the things that was always a challenge for researchers is when you're working with a witness, especially a witness like Willingham, who's encountered so much, is you get a time frame, and then things may shift, and things may come back, and in his memory he brings other factors here. So
sure.
He's been through, like a lot of these other fighter pilots, you know, they definitely encountered something quite unusual, and
right.
there are some things that he mentioned that I'm still amazed and fascinated with. So
well, you and Noe wrote the book about the colonel, and are we going to have to revise the book any now?
Well, Noe and I are going to have to talk about that and see what we have to alter or add in. But again, the colonel story has so much richness of history behind it that we're going to need to look at how much we need to alter, and at the same time, new information that we need to go back.
Well, as I was going to say a minute ago or 2 minutes ago, the guy's been through World War II.
Yep.
The Korean War, and all this other stuff. Can you imagine at 87, 5 strokes, folks, and he still smokes?
And he has a great sense of humor, by the way.
He does. He's a wonderful man to talk to and listen to, and he's got that sparkle in his voice.
Just, absolutely.
Quite a guy. Noe, what do we know about Mr. Zekel?
Well, that is a very interesting character in UFO research circles, and we've been kind of trying to put our finger on exactly who Todd Zekel was for some years now. We actually had a dialogue going with Mr. Zekel prior to his unfortunate passing away in 2006. I was, at that point, Reuben and I were beginning to put together our preliminary outline for the book about Colonel Willingham's case, and so we had run across the name Todd Zekel as having been the first UFO investigator to give any credence to Willingham's story and to actually put it out there. He persuaded the colonel to file a written affidavit with NICAP in 1978, and Todd Zekel also arranged for a television documentary that was done by Japanese television. about the crash retrieval case involving Willingham. So, I mean, this was a UFO researcher who did a lot with the Willingham case, and he promised the colonel all along the way that he was going to write a major UFO book about Colonel Willingham's encounter and his experiences and so forth. But yet that book never did materialize, and Colonel Willingham was a little bit disappointed in that. So after Todd passed away in late in 2006, we talked to Colonel, and he was very much in favor of proceeding with writing a book in which he told his story.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did that, and we spent most of 2007 writing the book, and then we published it in 2008. And since then, Colonel Willingham has he's had some additional recollections, which most of which he shared with you over the course of the past two interviews. So we've spoken to Ruben about possibly modifying, although the core of the story remains unchanged.
Mm-hmm.
He gave some additional details that would be good to include in a revised version of our book.
Now, you found an article, Noe, at ufology.ca about Todd Zeckel. And just let me read the quote that you were kind enough to forward on to me, talking about Mr. Zeckel. And I quote, "He was a communications specialist with the Army Security Agency and NSA, where he had top-secret clearance. Zeckel began his career in ufology in 1976 as the National Director of Research for GSW, Inc., a Phoenix-based group specializing in computer enhancement analysis of photos and films." Now, if this is an accurate statement, Zeckel seems to fit exactly into the mold that the colonel described. NSA, security clearance.
There's a little bit of a contradiction about Zeckel.
What do we know?
He had access to some of the UFO secrets in the 50s and 60s, obviously, through the NSA and his government, being a government insider. He had access, we believe, to inside information about UFO cases. And yet, at the same time, later in his career, in the mid to late 70s, he became a rather important figure in the civilian UFO investigation movement. So this is interesting to us. It may go along with what the colonel hinted at several times when he talked to you, that he became disillusioned. Colonel Willingham became disillusioned with the way the UFO investigations were being handled by the military.
Right.
In the 50s and 60s, and it's possible that Todd Zeckel also had that same school of thought, that once having been an insider and then having made the decision that really this information should be accessible to the public, and he became famous in his latter part of his career by numerous Freedom of Information Act filings against the U.S. government seeking out documents and other evidence supporting the existence of UFOs and the fact that the U.S. had retrieved UFO materials from crash sites and so forth.
Sounds like he knew.
So that's a little bit of a, you know, something that comes through is kind of a two phases to his UFO career.
Sounds like Zeckel, with his NSA or security background, may have known where to look in terms of filing FOIA requests. And that would have caused some, certainly, unhappiness in certain circles. When we come back, I'd like to know from both of you if you have any further information about the colonel's relationship, however tenuous, with former President Johnson, Texas Oil, and Texas Oil. When we continue in just a couple minutes. back with Ruben and Noe. All right, Noe, what do you have to say about that? Anything?
Well, you've put your finger right on a very interesting connection. When we visited the colonel at his home near Wichita Falls, Texas, which is in northwest Texas,
mm-hmm.
Not too far from Fort Worth, he brought out files that he had for us to look at, pictures and documents. And we saw a number of citations and awards and certificates signed by Lyndon Baines Johnson. And interestingly enough, although the colonel had kind of run afoul of his military superiors back in the 50s after he had his UFO encounter, he received some threats from some of the folks in military intelligence telling him never to disclose what he saw down on the border.
Mm-hmm.
Even though all of that had happened, by the middle 60s, when LBJ was in office, he suddenly was promoted to the rank of colonel in the Air Force Reserve. So that happened under the tenure of LBJ as well.
I see.
Also during this time, he served on the American Security Council, because we scanned several documents and certificates where showed he was a member of the American Security Council in the mid-60s,
uh-huh.
and was also an advisor to the United States Congress. He was on the, we saw a commendation in his name, Colonel Robert B. Willingham, I'm looking at it right now,
mm-hmm.
from the United States Congressional Advisory Board,
hmm.
in recognition of his services as an advisor to the board. And the other thing that you mentioned also very, very astutely is the fact that there's the fact that Colonel Willingham comes from a family of oilmen in northwest Texas. His dad and other members of his family were longtime oil workers in various capacities. He mentioned that his dad was metallurgist for one of the largest oil companies in Texas at that time, in the 40s and 50s.
Hmm.
He himself worked with his daddy in the oil fields of North Texas for many years. Whenever Colonel Willingham was not serving in the military, when he returned and was
mm-hmm.
serving in the reserve,
right.
And then at that time he was working on the civilian end of things. He was working in the oil business as well. That would be in the late 50s on through the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
So there's definitely a connection between the Texas oil industry, the Lyndon Baines Johnson presidency,
hmm.
and Colonel Willingham's efforts to find out more about UFOs. In a bizarre way, those three elements become connected in Colonel Willingham's story.
What a! I just have the feeling, and you both worked with him personally for a long time, that if you could somehow access his life memory bank, it would be astounding.
Yes.
Just truly a remarkable man, and how sometimes the fates carry us into the most amazing situations.
You know, Jeff, we, as Noe had mentioned, that we were in contact with Zekel, and I mean, this story would have never have come out had we not persisted, and although it took Zekel to pass away, but it allowed us to go ahead and to work with the colonel and get the story out to the community. So, and as you're hearing, there's a lot more. There's a lot more to the colonel and his fascinating life.
Right.
I wanted to jump in here and talk about how we made an effort to try to get some of Zekel's materials, because he had a wealth of information at the time of his passing that he had worked. He had worked UFO cases for decades. But unfortunately, we found out that his family has disclosed that he took almost the entirety of his files, possibly the hundreds of thousands of pages, and just burned them, incinerated them in the days before his death. So I'm not
really clear what would motivate him to do that. Colonel Willingham had told us that he gave Zekel the main body of evidence that he had about both his military career and the UFO sightings. He had photographs and pictures. And, you know, in tonight's interview, when Colonel Willingham said that he had given those pictures to somebody who was writing the book, I was thinking in my mind that may very well have been Todd Zekel, who was on the receiving end of all those materials that mm-hmm. Colonel Willingham was talking about, because Todd Zekel kept mm-hmm. promising the colonel that he was going to write a book about his case. So he was gathering all this information from him, and then a book never materialized. And then we found out that shortly, you know, in the days before his death in 2006, we found out that his family indicates that Mr. Zekel destroyed most of those materials.
You know, just to jump in real quickly, too, that it seems that there might be this whole connection with the downfall of NICAP, because from my understanding or from different sources that there was a lot of infiltration by government agents that got into key decision-making, and basically there was a lot of chaos or whatever that caused the organization to disband. So it just seems to be right within the same time frame. So it sounds like that possibly Mr. Zekel was still connected as an insider. Hello?
That's a very discouraging thing. I'm just thinking here.
Yeah.
When Zekel passed, and people do that, and they take so much apparently with them. I mean, I don't. It gets me. If he's got material, and he was obviously involved with trying to present to the world the reality of the government's involvement and what the government knows and all the rest of it, why would he destroy it all? Why wouldn't he find someone who's trusted on you guys to leave it with? I mean, it's a strange and it's an odd conundrum when that happens. It always perplexes me.
We were very fortunate.
We made an appeal for those documents to Mr. Zekel, but he refused to give us access to them.
How did he act? How did he refuse you access?
Well, he was quite vehement. He said that the case was his alone, that he had worked it for many years.
Wow.
And that if we thought that he was just going to turn it over to somebody else, that we were sadly mistaken. That he had worked with the colonel, that he had known him for many, many years,
mm-hmm.
and that it was still his intention to release something,
mm-hmm.
even to the very end, he was saying that. So he never would disclose anything. All of the information that we got later was from the colonel himself, because Todd Zekel would not disclose anything to us.
Sounds like
to give us any information.
It sounds almost like there was some bitterness in the man.
Yes, we picked up on that very much so, but it wasn't because of the Willingham case. It was many other run-ins that he had had over the years with many disappointments that he had suffered.
Mm-hmm.
To the UFO community at large, he was often believed or characterized as being a disinformation agent or a UFO researcher who had been discredited,
mm-hmm.
and so he was very, very upset about all those bad remarks made by fellow UFO researchers.
Or fellow UFO researchers who were doing the work of the government, trying to discredit Todd Zekel, who may have been a rogue one-time insider who decided to go public, and they wanted to try to make his life hell.
Yeah, that is certainly possible. Because he spent the last decades of his life fighting for the freedom of information, using the Freedom of Information Act
uh-huh.
as a tool.
He knew where
to
look.
As much data mm-hmm. that he selectively was targeting about UFO cases, and he, you know, was successful in bringing out some important things, such as what Ruben was talking about. His FOIA request brought out the fact that the U.S. government was actively working to bring NICAP down as an organization, that it had been infiltrated by people from the government, and NICAP was seen as a threat, supposedly. So that was part of what came out through a disclosure through the efforts of Zuckel.
What we have that's very significant is we have the actual documentary, as Noe had pointed it out, the Japanese documentary where it showed Zuckel and Willingham going out to the crash site in Mexico. And there's a number of interviews. In fact, in our book, we have a number of the pictures that were used in the documentary. And actually, that picture of the crash metal piece that came from the documentary. So we, at least we have that as part of the historical records, and which, again, it just ties into perhaps, hopefully, we'll who knows, we might get some more information about Zuckel down the road, or it'll be just another chapter into this whole mystery.
Well, if he was working for the government, as the indications are, it may not be easy to substantiate that either. So you guys have your work cut out for you. Maybe there is, from these two interviews, there are new doors to walk through and new areas to look at. I'll be intrigued to see where it goes. Reuben, thank you so much for everything again.
Well, thank you, Jeff, for having both Noe and I back. And, hey, we may have something just as significant at a later show for you.
I'll look forward to it anytime at all. Noe, thank you, sir. Great to talk to you again, too.
Yes, thank you. Have a great rest of the show. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Noe. Good night, gentlemen.
Good night.
All right, we'll pause and come right back with more in just a few minutes.